Alright, we're getting here on the bottom of Mem Gimel Amud Bet by the Gemara. The Gemara has an interaction here between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim with regards to their positions in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi says that you can pulverize it and then throw it to the wind, or you can throw it into the water. The Chachamim objected because it turns into Zevel, and then somebody's going to get benefit from that. And we have a requirement of Lo Yidbak Biyadcha Meuma Min Acherim, that you're not allowed to have any residual benefit, any type of benefit from the Avodah Zarah. And this does provide that type of benefit. So Tanya, Amar Lehem Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Yossi quotes from the Pasuk, that is, Minyan Adiyomo, even though the Pasuk's not from our Parsha. Lo Kvar Nemar, Bet Chatatchem, Asher Asitim Et Ha'egel, Lakachti, Va'esrof Oto Ba'esh, Va'ekot Oto Tachon Hetev, Ad Asher Adak Li'afar, Va'shlich Et Aparo El HaNachal Hayored Min Ahar. So here he quotes what Moshe Rabbeinu does to the Avodah Zarah of the Egel. He pulverizes it. He does also beforehand burn it up or heat it up. Esrofoto. Rashi over here notes, and he notes a number of times on the daf today, Aval meve esrof lav tiyufti. But from the fact that they burnt it down, that's not a question, because chokama de lo shochik le michubar ba dodi veinu nase zevel. As long as it's still attached, or it's still a whole unit, that doesn't make it into zevel because it's too big. When you need something to be fertilizer, to be beneficial, you need to pulverize it so that it's powdery and it can then be mixed with water or other items and then used to fertilize the fields. So Rashi sees the proof from the Pasuk, which says, ve'akoto to tachon. And that's what Rashi says, ve'akoto to tachon kamoti. That's the question. If you look at the Baal Tosafot on the previous Amud, he says, Nechini ra'ala faresh, the Rabbi Yossi aseifa. The question he's asking is from the latter half of the Pasuk, that Ashlich et aparo l'nachal, that he threw the stuff into the water. Samich, avalot zarko liyam elo lenar. The point is that he threw it into the river and not into the ocean. Benar enu elo kamo zere laruach. Throwing it into a river is the equivalent of dispersing it into the air. The Balei HaTosafot are perplexed by that understanding of Rashi, which seems to indicate that when they pulverized it or crushed it down, Moshe's intent was to then throw it out to the Ruach or disperse it, and that's the question of Rabbi Yossi. But that, in essence, ignores the fact that the Pasuk continues and says that they pulverized it and threw it into the water. So how could Rashi say that their intent was to throw it to the wind? Didn't Rabbi Yossi know the second half of the Pasuk that it was put into the water? And so therefore the Baal HaTosafot don't think that the question is from the mere fact that they pulverized it, but the fact that they pulverized it and then put it into the water. And that's the question over here, because they should have then pulverized it and put it into somewhere or something that would have destroyed it and not allowed it to be used. When you throw it into the Nachal, that means that you're putting it into waters that are going to be utilized by people. And that's the question of Rabbi Yossi. The answer of the Chachamim in either case is Amru Lo. So they said back to him, Misham Raya, Harei Omer. It says over there, Vayazer al Pnei Amayim, Vayashkad Bnei Yisrael. They sprinkled it or dispersed it over the water. And then he gave it to Bnei Yisrael to drink. Lo nitkaven el vodkan kisotot. He wanted to test them like sotot. And Rashi says the reason that he threw it into Ashlichat Afro and Lanachal, the reason that he threw it into the rivers, the leka lemechash lezevel. There's no problem of fertilizer. Behind the lo yishlichu liyam shalem. So then why did he pulverize it? Why don't you just throw it into the water in one big piece? Lo nitkaven el vodkan kisotot. According to Rashi, the reason they pulverized it was to be able to have it that they could ingest it. And according to the Baal HaTosafot, the reason they put it into the water was because they needed them to drink the water. It's like that bedika of the sota. So the answer is that this was an exceptional case that he put into a river because he needed to regather that which he threw out. Had it not been for that, he would have to throw it out into the yam. Here he has a specific purpose in mind, and he actually recaptured everything that he threw into the water in order to test them kisotot. The question that you have to ask is, why? Why did he have them drink kisotot? So the Gemara tells us that in terms of the Chet HaEgel, there were different punishments for different individuals who violated restriction against the Avodah Zarah. If they have Edim v'Hatra'ah, they were put to death. If there were Edim v'no Hatra'ah, then there was Karet. And if it was something that was only known to God, then they died in a Magefa. And here he had this B'dika Kisotot. So many ask, why do you need the B'dika at all? You have a punishment min HaShamayim. The person dies. Why do you need B'dika Kisotot? Well, there are those that want to suggest that it has to do with how well known the item was, or whether externally people could tell they had done something wrong. And that's why you need to be sotot. Sotot means something that's done in private. Something where we don't even know that the person was involved, or that his heart was with the worshipping of the ego. And that's why you need to be sotot. I think, and I just noted because it's this week's parsha as well, that the reason Moshe Rabbeinu does this is because there's a very common problem with people who do something wrong, and that is that they project the sin that they have done onto the object of the sin. That happens in the story with Amnon and Tamar. When Amnon is infatuated with Tamar, and he falls in love with her, eventually he ends up raping her. Right after the incident, it says that Amnon hated Tamar afterwards more than the love that he had had for her beforehand. There you see Amnon treating her right after that incident like a piece of dirt. And the reason is because he sees her as the object of the chait, but also as the chait itself. He sees her as an embodiment of the chait. And in that way, he separates the sin from himself and basically places the blame on the other party, or in the victim in this case, which was Tamar. The risk that we had here is that Moshe Rabbeinu comes down and he takes care of the ego and gets rid of the ego. Bnei Yisrael are not going to take the personal responsibility for that which had happened, because they're going to say it was the ego's fault. That's what caused us to worship, and now we got rid of the ego, everything's okay. Moshe Rabbeinu says that's not what's going to happen here. You are going to have to take responsibility for it. And how does he do that? He makes them internalize the sin of the ego. He makes them drink from the waters that have the ego sprinkled in it, and saying, you must deal with it. It's your personal responsibility, and it's you who sinned. And you're the ones who are going to have to do the tshuva over here and not blame it on the ego. You have to take responsibility for your actions. And this is a way to prevent that phenomenon of projection onto the object of the chait and force them to take responsibility for the chait. Amar lehem Rabbi Yossi, alok var ne'amar. They have a pasuk in Divrei Yamim which describes the tshuva movement of Asa HaMelech after he gets chastised by the Navi and told by the Navi what they need to do. So in that process of doing tshuva, it makes a comment about his mother. It says, "V'gamacha emasa melech hesira migvira," and Asa also deposed Macha, the mother of the king. He removed her from her standing or rank as the mother of the king. Asher astala hesira miflatet, because she had made some abomination for the Asherah. And then veichot asat miflatsta, and Asa cut down this abomination. And then by a date, he reduced it down to dust, pulverized it, and burnt it, and disposed of it into the Kidron Valley, the Kidron River. So here you have pieces of the Sukkim here, because it says Vechudai in the middle. Here, Rabbi Yossi is also showing them again, Vayadek, and then he put it into Nachal Kidron. Again, they pulverized it, and then put it into the river, but they don't have any problem with dumping it into the river after that happened. That sounds exactly like what Rabbi Yossi suggests. And again here, the Vayisrof doesn't do anything. Because Vayisrof, as Rashi noted before, keeps them as whole units or whole pieces. And then you're not going to have this problem of the fertilizer, because it doesn't fertilize unless it's pulverized. So Vayisrof, they're ignoring. Tosfot does point out over here that in general, we don't view pulverized or powdered metal as being something that provides fertilizing or is helpful for the vegetation. And he says, V'yesh lomar, that when the Gemara says it's not helpful, L'chudei v'dayin v'tzmiach, if it's just by itself, it doesn't help the items to grow. L'shul mizavel b'karka ha'megadel tzmachim, if you use it as fertilizer together with the earth or dirt that is there, or you put it into water, those together make it beneficial for the vegetation that's there. So if you simply have metal and metal crushings, you're not going to grow anything in it. But those metal crushings or that dust, together with the earth or the water that's there, that becomes beneficial to the growing of items there. And even though over here, the Vayisrof comes after the Vayadek, by Moshe Rabbeinu, he melts it, and then he crushes it or pulverizes it, and then he throws it into the water. And that's why Rabbi Yossi was bringing proof from that. On the other hand, over here, he first crushes it, then burns it, and then only afterwards throws it into Nachal Kidron. So here the burning comes afterwards, which could have been the possible answer of the Chachamim, that he did more than simply pulverize it. He burnt it afterwards in order to remove any semblance of there being a problem. And then when he threw it into the water after that, it was as if it was a nothing. They could have answered that. Either you have to read the Pasuk being that Vayadek Vayisrof, really means that he first burnt it or melted it and then pulverized it. or the fact that he heated it up afterwards makes no difference to the beneficial qualities of this item. And when he throws it into the water, you still have the same question. Well, that actually might be the answer to the question posed by the Baal Tosafot, who says that metal shavings or pulverized metal is not usually beneficial for growing things in. The answer might be that after you burn it, then it has beneficial qualities to it. Amrulo, so the Chachamim said back to Misham Raya, from there you have a proof, Nachal Kidron enu migadel tzmachim. Nachal Kidron doesn't grow anything. It's a area that's not fertile, so what does it matter that they threw it down in Nachal Kidron? Nachal Kidron is going to take it, and there's nothing to do with that water over there. There's nothing planted down there. Velo, is that really true? V'atanyo, it's really v'atnan. We have a Mishnah. Elu ve'elu mitarvim ba'ama, yotzim le'nachal Kidron. They both mix together, and then they descend to Nachal Kidron. Benim karim le'gananim le'zevel, and then they sell it to the gardeners for fertilizer. U'mo'alin behen. And they do have me'ilah. If you don't pay for it, there is me'ilah. Here it's a description from the Mishnah in Yoma about the Yisod HaMizbeach HaChitzon. On the base of the Mizbeach HaChitzon, there are two holes there to pour the Shayere HaDam, the leftovers of the remaining dam into them. There's one on the southern side, which is where the majority of Karbanot, the extra dam, was poured. And there's one on the Ma'aravi, on the western side. They're at the corner, on the southwestern corner. One of them on the western side, one of them on the southern side. All normal korbanot, the extra dam or the leftover dam was poured on the Yisod Hadromi, whereas on Yom Kippur, or when you dealt with other korbanot that are brought into the Heichal, including the Par Kohen Mashiach, or the Seir L'Avodah Zarah, or Par Helam Dover Shel Tzibor, there the leftover dam was poured on the Yisod HaMa'aravi, on the western one, and it basically has to do with which is closer to you, when you exit from doing whatever you have to do with the dam. So when you're coming out of the Heichal, the one closer to you is the western one on the Mizbeach, because that's facing the Heichal. On the other hand, when you come off the Mizbeach, the ramp of the Mizbeach is on the southern side, and therefore you're going to be closest to the Yisod HaDromi, and that's where the blood was poured. There the Mishnah describes that Elu Ve'elu Mitarvim Ba'ama, and Ama down, they no longer remain separate, they come together into a single piping, Ve'otzim L'Nachal Kidron. And then they exit out to Nachal Kidron. The way Rashi describes it is that it also met up with the Amat HaMayim, with the Amat HaMayim that flowed through the Beit HaMikdash and brought water into the Mikdash and also took out whatever was needing removing. So that water that flowed out of the Mikdash and then flowed down to Nachal Kidron took with it this dam. The truth is that not all guides know this, but if you go in the southern excavations, you can see the staircase that descends from the Beit HaMikdash. The middle of that staircase is actually a drainage channel that takes you out to Nachal Kidron. And at the time, they did tests on that drainage channel, and they found in it cells of blood from animals. They believed that that was the channel out that was being described over here that went down to Nachal Kidron. Because when you're at the southeastern corner, when you have to see those stairs, you can see that they are leading down to the drain line. It's going out towards Nachal Kidron, and that's what's being described here. Then it was sold to the Gananim, the Zebel, because the water mixed with the blood of the animals was very good fertilizer. U'mo'alim behem, as Rashi notes over here, this is not mi'ilah do'oraita, because achar she'nase mitzvata, after the mitzvah is done by the korban, there's no din of mi'ilah, there's also no din of mi'ilah by the dam, and so it can't be speaking about mi'ilah do'oraita, but rather it's a mi'ilah de'rabanan, that you shouldn't get benefit from the mikdash without compensating the mikdash for that. And so that's what it means, mo'alim behem. So the Gemara answers, mikomot, mikomot, yeshbo. There are different locations down there. Yesh makom migadel tzmachim. Yesh makom she'eno migadel tzmachim. There are locations that do grow and are fertile down there, and the locations that don't grow. That's why they were able to throw it down there. He threw it down into the areas that were not farmed or not planted. Baal Tosafot point out, the Gemara probably had an easier answer, which was that the people coming to buy the water and the fertilizer, they didn't live in Nachal Kidron. They weren't planted in Nachal Kidron. They just came from somewhere else to buy it. Now, that may be difficult, only because probably the Baal Tosafot never saw Nachal Kidron, about how deep it is and how difficult it probably was to take the water. If you took water from there to draw the water and carry it out of Nachal Kidron, I don't know how practical it was to take that water to somewhere else in order to plant. So maybe it was just impractical, and that's why the Gemara doesn't give that suggestion. But Baal Tosafot do suggest that that could be an alternative. Now the Gemara asks about the Pasuk, about Macha, and Asa, my Miflitzata. That Miflitzata that he pulverized and then threw into the water. What exactly was that? So Amar Rav Yehuda, Dava Mafli Leitzanuta. So Rashi says over here the word Mafli, like when we say Mufei Kol Basar Umafli Lasot, that Hashem does wonders, or it's wondrous His ways. So Rashi translates Mafli as being something that's great or intense, and then Leitzanuta is either depravity or licentiousness. I mean, it was something that was terrible, and the Mafli only increases. It's modifying the Leitzanuta. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot look at the word Mafli not as being something which describes the intensity or the greatness of that which it is, but rather that it is a description of what type of Leitzanuta it is, which is that it was La'ag. It was a form of mockery or making fun. That's the nature of this brevity or licentiousness, which was mocking in nature or very negative in nature. But Kedetani Rav Yosef, and what exactly was that? Kemin zichrut astala. Vaitani ve'elet lo b'kol yom. She made either a member or a male image that she used to have biyah with on each day. And that was the mockery or the terrible thing that she used to do. That does have some connection to the Asherah, which seems to be what was planted there by the mother of Asa, which is that in that day, there was a lot of znut or arayot that were connected to the Avodah Zarah. That was part of what was so appealing about it, which is that it gave you a free rein or opened up that ability to engage in these types of activities. And then in Nevi'im, when they are chastising the people, they chastise them about all their images or things on the high places, as well as the zonot. The zonot were part and parcel of what was considered there the Avodah Zarah. So to over here, the Gemara is describing both that there was this Avodah Zarah, as well as some sort of impropriety that was going on there, and that's what's being described. Amalein Rabbi Yossi, Halo Kvar Ne'amar, doesn't it say about Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Michitat Nechash Nechoshet Asher Asa Moshe, that he cut down, he destroyed the copper snake that Moshe Rabbeinu had made? Amrulo Misham Raya, that's not a proof. Hari Omer, doesn't it say, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Aseh Lecha Saraf, Lecha Mishalcha, that when Moshe is commanded to make the copper snake, which is the copper snake twisted around the staff, the modern-day sign for medicine, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's asked to make it, says, Lecha, for you, Mishalcha. You have to do it out of your personal money. You have to make this. Ven Adam Moseh Devar Sheinu Shelo. And over there, it doesn't really matter that people worshipped it, because it doesn't make it into Avodah Zarah. You can only change something where you have balut on it. There you can make it into Avodah Zarah. You can't usurp someone else's property and make it into Avodah Zarah. With the exception, maybe, if action is taken on the animal, or there's something done that actually affects the item itself. But then you're involved with Gnevar Gzeilah. Over here, in terms of making it into Avodah Zarah, you don't have the right to make someone else's property into Avodah Zarah. So since it belongs to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's personal property of Moshe Rabbeinu, you couldn't make it into Avodah Zarah. So then, why did Chizkiyahu HaMelech cut it up and destroy it? He didn't have to destroy it. He didn't have to do anything to it. He saw people were following after it or being drawn to worship it instead of using its healing powers for the benefit and realizing it was coming through Hashem. They began to ascribe the powers to the Nechash HaKoshet itself, and then they began to worship the Nechash HaKoshet. That's what the Rambam describes in Hilchot Avodah Zarah. The whole development or evolution of Avodah Zarah is always this way. Everything begins out as something that really is immediate to Hashem, or in some ways provides a benefit, but everybody recognizes that comes from Hashem, and eventually people lose contact or connection to the source or understanding of where this is coming from, and they begin to worship the median instead of Kodesh Baruch Hu, who's providing that power. And a similar thing happened over here. Hamat, Bikitito, he went ahead and destroyed it. The Chachamim see this as being extrajudicial. They didn't have to destroy it. It wasn't Avodah Zarah, because the people worshiping it weren't the ones who owned it. They didn't have balut over it, so therefore they couldn't affect the Nechash HaNechoshet. So why did Chizkiyahu then destroy it anyway? It's because of the problem it was causing. Similar to the ephod of Gidon or Yubal, where they had made an ephod during his lifetime that he put it up as a reminder to Hashem. But after his death, the people start to worship the ephod. And the Navi says that that was a problem for him and his family, Because, in a sense, he had done it for the right reasons, but it became a mikshol, became a stumbling block or a obstacle to the other people when they started to worship the ephod. And similarly over here, the nechash nechoshet was something positive, but in the end they began to worship it, and that caused problems. And we know from the Gemara in Pesachim, the Mishnayot there speak about different things that Chizkiyahu HaMelech did. Six things, three of which the Chachamim agreed, and three which they did not agree. This is amongst those three that the Chachamim gave approval that Chizkiyahu HaMelech did this, because it was causing problems. So again, he might have confiscated the property, whether he had to use Hefker, Beit Din Hefker, or however he did it. He realized there was a problem going on, and he needed to deal with it. Even though it wasn't a problem where the object itself was a source of Avodah Zarah, the object itself was the problem. And so he liberated himself of the problem, but you can't prove anything from here about Avodah Zarah in general. Amar Lahem, so Rabbi Yossi brings another pasuk. Alok Kvar Ne'amar, doesn't it say by David HaMelech, when he's fighting the battle against the Plishtim and Baal Pratsim, it says over there that David, after asking God whether he should attack them, is successful in the battle and drives away the Plishtim, and it says there, Vayazvu Shamet Atzavehem, they left their idols behind, Vayisayim David Vanashav, and David and his men carried them off. Umay Mashma, Dahai Vayisayim David, Lishnat Izruyehu. How do you know that when it says David carried them off, that means that he threw them to the wind? That's not what it sounds like. Vayisayim sounds like he literally walked off with them and he kept them. So how do you know that? Kimitar Game Rav Yosef. Because of the Targum, the translation that Rav Yosef has into Aramaic of a different pasuk from Yishayahu HaMelech. Just note here, other places in Shas, Rashi notes this, that the reason that Rav Yosef was an expert in Targum is Rav Yosef fell ill in the middle of his lifetime, and at some point he lost his ability to see. He became blind. And since there is a requirement that when you deal with Torah Shebichtav, that you have to read it mitoch haktav, you have to read it out of the Ktav. Rav Yosef, who could no longer see, couldn't learn Torah Shebichtav in the Hebrew format because he couldn't read it anymore. So therefore, he became an expert in the Targum, in the translation of the Psukim, because Aramaic you can say by heart. The translation you can say by heart. And that's why Rav Yosef is always quoted as being an expert in the Targum, and that's also over here. Kimitargim Rav Yosef, Tizreim beruach tisaim, that you will scatter them, and the wind will carry them away. Umitargamina, the translation of that is, Tazrinun, you will disperse them, scatter them, beruach titaltilinun, and the wind will carry them away. So you see that the word tisaim, when it means to carry away, is also used in the context not of a person carrying it away, but rather the wind carrying it away. And therefore, the meaning of the pasuk by David is not that they walked away with them, but by isaim, they caused them to float with the wind, or they caused them to be carried away by the wind. Amru lo misham rayat, can't prove anything from that pasuk in Shmuel, because Ari Omer, in Divrei Yamim, in the description of the same incident, it says, Vayazvu shamet Elohehem. So as opposed to Atzavehem, which was the word that's used in Shmuel Bet, over here it says that they actually left their gods. Vayomer David, Vayisarfu ba'esh. And David instructs the troops to go ahead and burn them or rid themselves of these gods that were left behind. Umigdoloktiv, since it doesn't say Vais Rafaim, Vaisaim, so it doesn't say that they burnt them up and then they dispersed them. Shmamina, Vaisaim Mamash. So that means that Vaisaim means literally Vaisaim, and therefore it's not a proof to you. You were saying to us, look here, they're dispersing it to the wind. So by definition, if they're dispersing it to the wind, they have to pulverize it or do something with it beforehand in order to allow them to scatter it out to the wind. So then the Rabbanan answer, Rabbi Yossi, and say, what do you mean? Scattering to the wind, we have another pasuk in Divrei Yamim that says that it was burnt up. So now you're going to tell me that they did both? They burnt it up like Moshe Rabbeinu, then pulverized it and then scattered it to the wind? That can't be the case because the pasuk doesn't do that. The pasuk does not bring both verbs in one place. That's telling you that whatever was done in one place was not done in the other place, and what you're saying is not correct. And that means the word Vayisayim means they literally carried it off. Mikol makom, kashu kraya dodi. Nevertheless, the psukim are a stira. Even according to the Chachamim, who say that David HaMelech carried it off, what is he going to do with the pasuk of Vayisarfu? Could Rav Huna, like Rav Huna explains, Rav Huna Rami, Rav Huna brought a stira in the psukim, Tiv, Vayomer David, Vayisarfu Beish, Uktiv, Vayisayim. Which one is it? Lo kasho. Kan kodem sheba itaya giti. Kan achar sheba itaya giti. Depends on when itaya giti joined the forces of David HaMelech. Itaya giti, from the sounds of it, came from Gat. And Gat was a Plishti city in the time of David HaMelech. We know that after they have the battle in Emek Ha'elah right here, when the Plishtim see that Goliath is killed, they all start running towards Gat, and then out towards Ashkelon and Ashdod. These were all Plishti cities in that time. If Itai Giti was a Plishti, then he was not Jewish. So the difference in what happened over here has to do with whether they had a Goy there in order to remove the problem of Avodah Zarah. So before Itai Giti joined the forces, they didn't have a Goy to remove the Avodah Zarah from it. After Itai Giti joined the forces, then they were able to have someone be Mevatel, the Avodah Zarah was not Jewish, and then they could walk off with it. So in the first case, Vayisafu Ba'esh, was either that was their intent, they were going to burn it and get rid of it, and then Itai Giti came along, so they didn't have to burn it anymore, and they could be Mevatel it, and then take it off. That's one way you could explain it. Or you can explain that they originally started to burn the items, and then when Itai Giti came along, they were able to carry off whatever was left over when he was Mevatelet, or possibly a difference between Vayomer David, what David told them to do, and in the end, what they did do, which is in the case of Vayisafu Ba'esh, that's Vayomer David. David told them to go burn it in the fire, but in the end, they didn't burn it in the fire because of Itai Giti came along and was Mevatel the Avodah Zarah, even though the truth is that Itai Giti does join the forces of David HaMelech much earlier on. That's a little bit of a question, but the Baalei Tosafot ask a more fundamental question based on the story that we saw yesterday with Rabbi Elazar HaKapar. Tema, lo lo kach ove kochavim levatel bar kocho. Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, why doesn't he just get a non-Jew, force him to be Mevatel it, and deal with it? What is he waiting for Itai Giti? He could have just pressed some Ovei Kochavim into dealing with the issue. So why is it that he didn't do that? So even though he does leave that as a Tzarech Iyun, nevertheless, he brings that the Yushalmi offers an alternative way to deal with the Stira and the Psukim, which would then somewhat avoid that problem. Yushalmi answers the Stira. Chen yesh terutzim Yushalmi kan v'shel etz, kan v'shel matechet. They burnt the things that were made out of wood, and then they carried off the things that were made out of metal. Dichtim, as the pasuk says in Shmuel Bet, where Yoav, David's general, goes out to fight against the Bnei Amon, and Yoav, in the end, right before he's able to conquer the city, calls for David, so that David can be the victorious king that comes in to conquer the city. It says there, Vayasuf David Kolam, Vayelech Rabata, Vayelech Heimba, Vayokeda. He fights against the city and captures it. He takes the crown of the king off his head, Mishkala, Kikar Zahav, and its weight was that of a Kikar Zahav, Eben Yikara, full of precious stones, by Tia Rosh David, and David wears it or puts it on. And there was great spoils that were taken out of the city. The simple way to read it, that after they conquered people of Moab, they took the crown of the king, Umishari. How could it be mutar for them to take the crown? So what's embedded in the Gemara here is that clearly they don't see this as the crown of the king, but rather the crown of the Avodah Zarah. And Rashi notes that the Torah tells us that the Avodah Zarah of Ammon and Moab, it's in the Torah, it says it one way, if you go into Sefer Shoftim, it attributes it to the other one. So it's both Ammon and Moab worship the Molech. Molech is the name of their Avodah Zarah, and therefore the reference here to Malkam is not to their king, but rather to the Molech, to the Avodah Zarah. And so then the Gemara is asking, how could they take the crown off the Avodah Zarah? Yisurei Ananinu. It was also by not because it was Avodah Zarah. So Amar Rav Nachman, Itai Giti ba ubitla. Itai Giti came and removed the problem of Avodah Zarah because he was mevatalit. Now the Gemara says, Mishkala Kikar Zahav. The weight was a Kikar Zahav. That is the amount of gold that was used in the formation of the menorah. So how do you have a crown that weighs the same weight as the golden candelabra in the Migdash, and then someone's going to put it on their head? Whoever wore a crown with that type of weight on it, it's just way too heavy in order for it to be worn as a crown. Not that he actually wore it, but it was fitting for the head of David. Now, fitting, you can look in one of two ways. You can take that literally, that it fit the head of David HaMelech, which we'll see the Gemara does in a little bit. Or fitting, it was befitting the head of David HaMelech, which was also true. You can read it in both of those ways. Yosef Rabbi Chanina Amar, Evin Shoevet Haita Ba, it had in it a magnet, Tava Dorolo, that kept it afloat or kept it suspended. Now the truth is, it's unlikely that the crown had the magnet in it. The way that the Baalei Tosafot describe it is, V'shaya Yosheva Kisei Malchuto, When David used to sit on his throne, menicha, he would put it on, but Evan Shoevet Shukalamala. But there was a magnet above it that pulled on the crown and helped suspend it above his head. So therefore he didn't need to bear the weight of the crown, because he had a magnet that was pulling it up from above. So that has to do with the iron content in the crown. But if there's enough iron content in the crown, then you can have a magnet pull up the crown. So that it's described here is that he basically slid under the crown. Or if he put it on, he had people carry it on top of him. As long as the magnet was there, it would keep the crown suspended above his head. And that's how it worked. Belazar Amar, Evan Yikara Haitaba. There was a precious stone in it, which is the remainder of the pasuk says that there was a precious stone. Sheshaveh kikar zahav. That was worth a kikar zahav. So kikar zahav is not a description of the weight or the content, but rather the value of the crown. So now the Gemara continues along these lines about the fact that the crown was appropriate for David HaMelech. Pasuk says in Tehillim, Zot aita li ki pikudecha natsarti. This was for me because I kept or I was shomer your commandments. My kamar. What is David HaMelech saying? Hachi kamar. Ki b'schar shepikudecha natsarti. Because I kept your laws, I was shomer your laws. Zoi tali le'edut. This was evidence of the fact that I was keeping your word, or I was chosen by you, God. Ma'eduta. What was the proof? I'm Rabbi Shua ben Levi, she'a menicha b'makom tefillin, v'holam to. That he was able to put on this crown, in place of his tefillin, v'holam to, and it fit him. Vaha bayanuche tefillin. That's really good. But then how does he put on tefillin? If the crown fit him, and it was measured to the right size for him, then how did he actually get his tefillin on if it was sitting in the place where the tefillin were? So I'm Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak, makom yishesh perosh, shiroed laniach bo shtei tefillin. On the person's head, you actually can get on two pairs of tefillin. That's actually a machloket in the Rishonim, in the Gemara and Erevin, as to what the meaning of the Gemara is over here. The one possibility is that they are side to side. On your head, side by side, you have enough room for two pairs of tefillin. I did hear from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Zatzal's son that Rav Aaron believed that the pasuk, or the pashtuta pasuk of that Bayula Totofot Beinei Necha, between your eyes, means that you can fit it, the tefillin have to be not centered like we do, between your eyes, literally the inner parts of your eyes, rather the outer side of your eyes. Beinei Necha means that it from between here and here. That would actually leave enough room on the top of your head to put on two pairs of tefillin. Because Beinei Necha doesn't mean like we do, which is the internal sides of the eyes between them, where we have it on the arch of the nose, we line it up. But rather it means Beinei Necha from the outer edges of your eyes. And that would give you room to have two pairs of tefillin next to each other. Although the majority of Rishonim believe that when it says you can put on two pairs of tefillin, that means one behind the other. And that the description that the Gemara gives about the soft part of the baby's head or the soft part of your skull, there's actually room from the front of your hairline back towards the top of your head. There's actually room there in that soft spot to put in two pairs of tefillin, one behind the other. Today you can see some Sfaradim and some Kabbalists who want to put on more than one pair of tefillin. They sometimes wear Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam together, or they wear the Shari Doras tefillin at the same time. But some people do put on two pairs of tefillin at once, mostly on the head rather than the arm. It's a little harder on the arm to do something like that. But on the head, you have room to put on two pairs of tefillin. Now, here Rashi gives an interesting explanation. He says, Kom sheish brosho d'roi laniach sham bet tefillin, sh'rochav ha'charitz. So the width of the depression, makom krach shnei ritzuot. You have the ability to put on two sets of ritzuot over there. V'hi aita nocha b'chatzi rochbo. And it only sat on half of that area. The crown only covered half of that area. It's not clear from Rashi if he's saying that the tefillin can be placed side by side, because he focuses on the ritzuot and not the tefillin. He says there's room to the side to put on two sets of ritzuot. Does that mean that he thinks you can put on two tefillin side by side? Does he mean that you put one tefillin behind the other, and you have room for two sets of ritzuot that'll go around the back of your head? It's not clear from what Rashi means, because he speaks about the width, but then he also speaks about the ritzuot. Or Rashi could be saying, when he mentions this charitz, he's talking about the circular nature of the head that would have been fitting for this crown. And the charitz is the location where the crown itself sits. And what he's saying is that the width of that charitz, where the crown sits, also has room for the straps of the tefillin to be in it. If you were to think about a groove that goes in a circle around the head of the individual, and upon that the crown sits, then in that groove, if the groove is thick enough or wide enough, that the straps of the tefillin can also go around the head in that same groove. So the crown sits in a similar fashion, with the base of the crown around the head there, and the tefillin sit in a similar fashion, which is the straps of the tefillin going around in the same direction as the crown, and that may be what Rashi is referring to. But he's obviously raising that issue, which is, when it says you can put on two pairs of tefillin, what does that mean? Side by side, or front to back? So, v'yotziu et ben ha-melech, v'yinu alav et ha-nezer v'et ha-idut. When Atalia, the daughter of Achav, sees that her son Achaziah was killed in the revolution that Yehu leads against his uncle in the north while he was visiting there and ends up killing Achaziah as well, she decides that she's going to wipe out all remnant of anyone who could inherit the throne and appoint herself as the queen. In that incident, Vaitikach Yushavat bat melech et Yoash ben Achaziah, the sister of Yoash, who was the sole remaining survivor now of Achaziah after Ataliah had killed everyone out, she prevented him from being killed by secreting him out and taking him to the Beit HaMikdash and hiding him with Yoyada Kohen in the Beit HaMikdash. And later on, after he grows a little older and the time is ripe, Yoyada instructs the Kohanim, the Levim, to bring him out and then to anoint him and appoint him as the king. And once he does that, the people rally behind the king, and they end up disposing of or removing Ataliah. When they go to crown him as the king, it says over there, Vayotziu et ben ha-melech, vayitnu alav et nezer v'et ha-idut, vayamlichu oto. They took out and they put the crown and the testimony, and they declared him the king. And then he was anointed by Yoyada and his children, the Kohanim, and they said, long live the king. And when Ataliah sees that or gets wind of that, she says, there is an insurrection, there's treason going on over here, stop them. But the people already rallied behind the king, and they turn on Ataliah, and they grab her, and they end up killing her for all that she had done. And after that, Yoash becomes the king. So now, Nezer Zo Klila. The Nezer means the Klila. Klila means a crown or a wreath. That refers to the crown itself. Eidut, what was the testimony? The Pasuk says that it is Nezer Veta Eidut. What's the Eidut? Rav Yehuda Amarav, Eidut the Beit David, Shukola Ro'i Lamachot Holamto. That anybody who is worthy of being the king, the crown fits him. It's like the story of Cinderella. If the shoe fits, then it must be you. So same thing over here. If the crown fits, then it must be that you are deserving of the kingship. And whoever was not appropriate for the kingship, the crown did not fit them. If you remember, we saw in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that there was actually a piping down the middle of the crown, and that's what it meant that it had to fit the individual, which was it wasn't just a regular round crown. It actually had a metal pipe down the middle, and therefore you needed a charitz, as Rashi said. You needed some groove in your head to allow the crown to sit. Seems a little strange, because it wouldn't have looked so normal for the person. That's what Rashi describes there in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Over here, it seems to be that it's speaking about the roundness of the crown, or how the crown sits on the individual in terms of its fit. And you can see that in Balei Tosafot, that they say that the fact that the crown, which was round, fit on its head at the place where the tefillin are, which is not a rounded part of the head, that was the miracle, and that's what it meant, that it fit the head of David. And then the Gemara says, Va'adunia ben chagit minaseh leimor. So Adunia, when David is ill and is very elderly, Adunia sees himself as the crown prince because his older brothers who would have gone before him have been killed. Both Amnon and Avshalom have already been killed. So that leaves Adunia as the next in line. Meantime, David has no intentions of giving it to Adunia. He wants to give it to Shlomo Melech, who was way down the line, but he had promised that to Bathsheba, and we know that Natan and Navi also tells him that Shlomo HaMelech is going to be the one that reigns after him. So Adoniah, of his own initiative, decides, David's on his deathbed, that he's going to start a process by where he's going to become the crown prince. Mitnasele Mor, he was carrying on saying, Ani Amloch, I'm going to be the future king. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Shemitnasele, the whole Mo, V'lo Olamto. He tried to get the crown to fit him, but it didn't fit him. That's what it means, Mitnasele. He was trying. He didn't succeed because the crown didn't fit him, but he's trying to get the crown to fit him. He had for himself a chariot and cavalry men, and 50 men running in front of him. What's the chiddush that he had 50 men running in front of him? Either because 50 is just not a big number. If you go back to the story of Avshalom, Avshalom had 200 men running in front of him. So what is 50 men running in front of him? So what was unique about these 50? Rather than the larger numbers you would expect for someone who was a crown prince. Or, Rashi says over here, the Gemara's question stems from the fact that, by Yaslo, that he did something particular what was the asiya that was so significant about these 50 men? Tana, kulam netule tcho, that they had their spleens removed. Bechakuke kapot raglaim hayu. And Rashi says that they had some surgery done on their feet, which removed the skin and the flesh on their feet so that they didn't have any feeling down there. And that made it easy for them to run. Supposedly, if you had your spleen removed, you felt lighter and you were able to run faster. And if your feet weren't affected by what you stepped on, then you'd also run faster because you couldn't feel that you were stepping on thorns and brambles or any other sharp object because you could just run with it. So that's what the significance is, that these were unique individuals that had that capacity to run. Right now, we start the next Mishnah. Mishnah says, Sha'al Proklos et Polospos. It's obviously a Greek name. And later on in the story, you'll see that he is a person that has a certain amount of political power or a Roman authority. So this individual asked for Bingamliel, Ba'ako. Ako, which would have been a port city at the time, also close to Caesarea, which was the Roman seat of government, that they were actually going into the bathhouse of Aphrodite, who was the goddess of beauty and procreation. So many times in the bathhouses, they used to have an idol in the bathhouse, but that meant that the bathhouse was dedicated to the idol, or the idol adorned the bathhouse. That's going to be the discussion over here. But many times it was either the goddess Hygiena, or it was the goddess Aphrodite, because they had relationships to going to the bathhouse, cleaning oneself as Hygiena. And Aphrodite was the goddess of beauty, or the goddess of procreation, which also would be connected to bathing oneself and preparing oneself. Or it could just simply be that because, in general, Aphrodite was represented by a young woman, they felt that that was a nice way to decorate the men's bathhouse. Amarlay. The box changes the language here to Amarlo instead of Amarlay, because we're in a Mishnah, and in a Mishnah you wouldn't find necessarily Aramaic. It should be Hebrew in the Mishnah. So the Bach changes it from Amarlay to Amarlo. Ketuba Torahchem. So he says, familiar with the Torah, Lo yibach biyadcha meumah min acherim. You're not allowed to have any residual benefit or any benefit whatsoever from Avodah Zarah. I don't know if he really quoted the Pasuk, but he knew the practice of the Jews was not to get involved or to come into contact or get any benefit from Avodah Zarah. And that's his question to him. Why are you coming in here and bathing in the bathhouse of Aphrodite's? Amarlo, Emi Shivim Bermerchatz. Says, I can't answer you in the Merchatz. Divrei Torah, I can't answer you right now. Ukashiyatza, when they exited, Amarlo, Ani lo bati bigvula, I didn't come into her bathhouse. He ba'a bigvuli, she came into my bathhouse. The bathhouse preceded her, and she was put in here after the bathhouse was built. She's actually bothering me. I came to the bathhouse, and she was here. But I'm not coming into her bathhouse. Ein omrim, because we don't say, Nase merchatz noi l'Aphroditi. We don't say, make the bathhouse as a decoration or an adornment to Aphrodite's. Elomir Nase Aphrodite, nor the merchatz. You put up the goddess of Aphrodite in the merchatz in order to adorn or decorate the bathhouse. So you see which is the ikar and which is the tafel. The ikar is the bathhouse, and the decoration or the adornment is Aphrodite's. It's not the other way around. We have the goddess Aphrodite's, and then they make a bathhouse in her honor. That's not the way it works. It's done in the reverse. The way that Rashi reads this is that the first answer that he gives is, Ani lo bati bigvula, hi ba bigvuli. The Beit HaMerchatz was built first, and that means that I had equal access and use of the Beit HaMerchatz before she showed up. And so she doesn't have a right to displace me from the Beit HaMerchatz. And then Rashi claims that Ein Omrim is Davar Acher. Vod Shuba Acheret. And another answer is, Ein Anu Omrim Nase Merchatz Nor Aphrodite. This is a separate answer, which is, if you think about it, you don't make a bathhouse as an adornment to the goddess. It's just actually the opposite way around. You make the goddess the adornment or decoration for the bathhouse. So according to Rashi, those are two separate answers, although others suggest that it's just a continuation of the first answer, which is the merchatz was there first and not the goddess. And even if you put the goddess in there afterwards and say that the people that are coming to bathe are bathing in the honor of the goddess, that's just not true because of the nature of the relationship between which item is adorning the other item. Davar acher, another thing is, Im notim lecha mamon arbei, iyata nichnas levodat kovim shalcha arum. First of all, if they paid you all the money in the world, you wouldn't go naked into your avodah zarah. Ubal keri, or someone who's had a semen omission, or mashtin befanel, or you would not relieve yourself in front of it. Zo omedet al pi abiv. They usually put up the statue over the drainage line out of the bathhouse. In Israel, you can see some of the archaeological digs that have Roman bathhouses that they found, and that there are different water movements throughout the bathhouses with the cold water, the hot water, and then there's a drain at the end there which drains everything out of the bathhouse. So over there, they usually had a pedestal or a platform above it, the apse, upon which the Avodah Zarah was placed, because that was at the end of the bathhouse, one end of the bathhouse, and that's where the water drained out. And that's where they used to put the idol. So meantime, what's happening here is all the water that's going out of the bathhouse, it's running under her. So that means that everybody is coming to the bathhouse naked, and anything they do there, if they relieve themselves or they're cleaning themselves, all that dirty stuff goes right out under the Avodah Zarah. And he says, is that the way to treat your Avodah Zarah, the thing that you want to give reverence to? She's sitting on the sewer pipe or the sewer line, and everybody is relieving themselves in front of her. Lo namar el Elohim. It only says that there's a restriction against gods. Etch noheg bo mishum Eloa asur. If they treat it like a god, then it's problematic. Etch noheg bo mishum Eloa mutar. They don't treat it like a god, then it's not restricted. So here he says, I can prove to you that they don't look at Aphrodite here as a Avodah Zarah, as a goddess, because the way they treat her or the way they act in front of her. So by the mere fact that that's the way they act, is evidence of the fact that they don't think she's a goddess and she's just an adornment there. They're not treating it like a Avodah Zarah. So that's the second reason why he thinks that it's not a problem to go into the bathhouse of Aphrodite's. How did Rabbi Gamliel do such a thing? The Gemara here is perplexed, not by the conversation, by the fact that Rabbi Gamliel responded to this proklus when they were in the main area of the bathhouse, meaning that in the central area or the inner chamber of the bathhouse where they were naked, he responded to them and said, I'm not allowed to speak about it here. That is a halachic statement, which is I'm not allowed to speak about it here, which is telling the halacha. How could he make an halachic statement in that part of the bathhouse? And the Rabbeinu Chananel tells you that directly, that that's the problem here, because it says, V'hechi shari, the Rabban Gamliel, the Meimar, le b'merchatz, emishavim b'merchatz. How was he permitted to tell him in the bathhouse that you're not allowed to answer in the bathhouse? I mean, that he was giving him a halachic psak, speaking in Torah, in the Beit HaMerchatz, in order to tell him that he had to wait till later. V'amar Rabba Barchanam, Rabbi Yonatan, v'chol makom mutar laharher, chutz mi Beit HaMerchatz, umi Beit HaKisei. One can have thoughts of Torah anywhere, with the exception of places where it's inappropriate. And the inappropriate places are the Beit HaMerchatz and the Beit HaKisei. It's the bathroom and the bathhouse. Because in both of those areas, the person is naked or relieving themselves. It's inappropriate to be thinking about the Beit Torah. B'chitema, if you want to suggest that B'lashon Chol, Amarle, that he did it in another language. He was speaking to him in Roman, he was speaking to him in Greek, and therefore was allowed. B'amar Abaye, then Abaye say, Dvarim Shel Chol Mutar L'Omram B'lashon Kodesh. If they are secular matters, you're allowed to speak about them in Hebrew. Dvarim shel kodesh, if they are Torah matters, asur l'omran b'lashon chol. Even if you speak about them in another language, they are still problematic. What Abai is saying is the content is important, not the language that you use. Hebrew isn't inherently kadosh. It is only kadosh because you speak Torah in Lashon HaKodesh. Torah is given in Lashon HaKodesh. So when you're reading Torah, when you're learning Torah, then the Hebrew has kedusha to it. When you're speaking about mundane matters with Hebrew, that's exactly what they are. They're mundane matters. There's no problem in using Hebrew for mundane matters, even if you're doing it in the bathroom, in the Beit HaMerchatz, wherever it is, that's not an issue. Hebrew is not inherently problematic. It does not have an inherent kedusha to it, which is interesting in and of itself, because we think of it as Lashon HaKodesh, and that's the way the Gemara describes it over here. But the answer is that it's Lashon HaKodesh because the Torah is given in it. And that is the Lashon of the Kedusha. But that doesn't make the Lashon itself Kadosh. It just means that the Torah that's given in that language gives it or assigns it that name of Kedusha. And the other way around, if you use foreign languages, if you speak in English, like here when we're learning Torah, that is considered to be words of Torah. There's no diminishment because you're speaking in a foreign language to the content that is content of Torah. And so over here, if he spoke to him even in a different language, he was still giving a psak halacha that he's not allowed to speak about in this area. Tana, kishiyatsa amarlo. That when he left, he said to him, emishavim amarchatz. So the way the Gemara describes it over here, it means that he was silent when he first asked him the question in the merchatz. They got out to the outer area where he could speak in Torah, told him, I couldn't answer you because you're not allowed to speak about Divrei Torah here. and I'll tell you outside, or I'll give you more information when we get out of here. It's an interesting solution to the problem. Tosfot seems to see this answer not as an emendation to the Mishnah, but rather a description of a braita that seems to say that kishiyatza marlei emi shivim b'merchatz, but that doesn't solve the problem of the Mishnah. If you say that the Tana over here is emendation of the Mishnah or rereading of the Mishnah, then he might be able to get over the problem, but what the Rabbeinu Elchanan points out is, that doesn't really read into the words. The way that our Mishnah reads, the Kishiyatzah, is after he already made that statement. So how are you going to explain that which is said in our Mishnah? That the Balei HaTosafot rely on the Gemara in Shabbat, that tells us that there are actually three different locations and statuses of chambers that are found inside of the bathhouse. V'omeri, the Gimel Batim Yesh Bamerchatz. Again, if you go see the Roman bathhouses that they found, you can see this. They have different chambers. Pnimi, the inner chamber, Ein Bo Shelat Shalom, Bein Sham Divrei Torah. The inner chamber is the chamber where they actually bathe and everybody's naked. There you're not allowed to say Shalom because it has the Shem Hashem associated with it. And you're not allowed to speak in Divrei Torah. In Emtzai, the middle one, Yesh Bo Shelat Shalom, Bein Sham Divrei Torah. There you're allowed to greet individuals and say Shalom, but you can't speak in Torah. Chitzon mutar af b'divrei Torah. The outer chamber is even mutar b'divrei Torah. And that's what it says over here. Kishiyatza mi beit apnimi le'emtzai. When they went from the inner chamber to the middle chamber, eshivoi mishivim b'merchatz. That's when he told him that I can't answer you in the bathhouse. U'mishum darche shalom eshivo. And he did it because of darche shalom. Here you have a Roman authority that's asking him a question and he's ignoring him. So he didn't want him to come away thinking that Rav Gamliel didn't respond to him or was ignoring him. So therefore, when they moved from the inner chamber where it's completely asur to the middle chamber where there are some dispensations, including saying shalom or greeting someone. So he viewed this as being darche shalom, but a type of greeting, which is, I can't deal with it now. I'll talk to you when we get outside. And that's what it means, mishiyatza. So there were different yitziot. You have multiple yitziot. The first yitziot was from the inner chamber to the middle chamber. That's when he responded to him. And then when they moved to the outer chamber, then he actually gave them the full answers that are found in the Mishnah, and that's Miyashayatza. In the Mishnah is the second time that he went out, meaning they went from the middle chamber to the outer chamber. That's how the Balei Tosafot deal with it. And even though the Gemara in Shabbat brings that Rabbi did give some sort of psak like this in the Beit HaMerchatz, there the Gemara answers that it was Lafushe Misura. That was to separate away from Isur. So you can't say something in a succinct manner if you're trying to stop someone from doing anything that is asur. But over here, he was speaking to a non-Jewish individual. There was no al-fushe misur over here. Therefore, there's no justification for him even speaking to him or responding to him in any way with regards to the Divrei Torah. I'm Rabbi Chama bar Yosef, Beribi. So this is interesting. If you look in the Masorta Shas over here, he points out that the title Berabi or Beribi, which is the Gadol Ador or the Great One, we actually don't find that accolade of Beribi associated with an Amora, only with a Tana. And for that reason, the Masorta Shas prefers the Girsa of Amar Rabbi Chama Rabbi Yosef, Amar Rabbi Shaya, without Beribi. But if you look in the Bach, he moves the accolade from Rabbi Chama Rabbi Yosef to Rabbi Shaya. He says, Tshuva Gnuva Heshivo Rabban Gamliel. Lo to Hegmon. So here you see that this individual, Proclus, was not your average individual. He was Hegmon from the Roman political echelons. The way Rashi describes it is, Dacheu Bekash. He pushed him away with straw. He gave him an answer that's not really an answer. He didn't really address the issue. It was a meaningless dismissal of the claim of Proclus by Rabban Gamliel. He just wanted to talk him out of it. And so he gave him an answer. But the answer doesn't really have a look standing to it. And that's what's being discussed over here, according to Rashi. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot say that the word gnuva is more likely translated not as being pushing away with empty air or a meaningless statement, but rather halama. It means to hide or to disguise. It means that he gave him a reason, but that reason wasn't clear because you need to look further into the reason to understand it more deeply, and then you can understand what exactly was the dechia. So he gave him something that on the surface felt like a dechia, but it really didn't have the essence of what was being said over here, because you need to plumb into the depths of his statement to understand how it was really a dechia, or why his statement really has halachic significance. V'ani omer eina gnuva. But I say that it wasn't a problematic. Ma gnuvte. Why would you have thought that it was a problematic answer, or a answer without any content to it? The kamar lo, zo meret al pi abif, v'chol adam mashtim b'faneha. That this is standing on the sewer line, and everybody urinates in front of her. V'chi mashtim b'faneha mayhavi. Just because you urinate in front of it, why does that mean that it's not considered avodah zarah? V'amar Rava pe'or yochiach. Didn't Rava say that pe'or can prove to you that sometimes the means of worship is something that is degrading? Shemifa'arim lifana b'chol yom, that they defecate in front of the poor every day. Veinu batel, and it's not batel. So here we have certain actions that an individual takes that show that he is no longer treating the avodah zarah with reverence, but rather degrading it, and that should be considered an automatic bitul. So one of the items that the Gemara discusses is defecating in front of the idol. Rava says you can't say that that is an automatic assumption of bitul, because we find that certain idols are worshipped by defecating in front of them. If that's the case, you can't then automatically assume that defecation means that he is mivatel the avodah zarah. V'ani omer eina gnuva. Why did Rabbi Chama bar Yosef say that I think it wasn't just an empty answer, but it was an answer that had real content to it? Zo avodata b'kach. We talk about the pa'or, that's the way that it's worshipped. Therefore, defecating in front of it is an indication of reverence rather than degradation. You're talking about Aphrodites, they don't worship her by urinating in front of her. They're urinating in front of her because that's the place to urinate. But that means that it's an indication of dismissal or not holding her up as an avodah zarah, because otherwise they wouldn't act in this way. They don't do this in front of any other avodah zarah. And therefore over here, it's obviously not being done because they think this is the way to worship her. They're doing it because that was the bathroom in the bathhouse. Amar Abaye, gnuvta mehalcha. So here you can see the Bach actually changes the girsa. Instead of being Amar Abaye, he changes it to Abaye Amar. And that would indicate that Abaye is arguing on Rabbi Chama bar Yosef in his explanation of why Rabbi Hoshaya said it was gnuva and why maybe it wasn't gnuva. Gnuvdata mehalcha. This is what it meant, that it was an answer that was not so strong. The Kamarle, he said to him, Anilo bati bigvula, he ba bigvuli. I didn't go into her territory, she came into my territory. Bichi ba bigvula, my havi. What would be the difference if he did go into her property? Vatznan. It comes with a Mishnah later on. Avodat kochavim, sheishla merchatz, ogina, nehenin mehen shalo betova. If you have an avodah zarah, and near that avodah zarah, there's a bathhouse, and there is a garden around it. It's clear that the central part of this area is the avodah zarah itself. That means that the garden that's there and the bathhouses that are there are in honor of the avodah zarah. And in that case, what Rabbi Gamliel said is not true. In that case, the bathhouse is dedicated to the avodah zarah. The garden is dedicated to the avodah zarah. And it says, nevertheless, you're allowed to get benefit from them. Shalom b'tova. Ve'nenimeh b'tova. But if you do give that compliment or credit, then it would be problematic. So Rashi over here says, Shalom b'tova, shalom yafsik tova l'komrim. As long as you're not giving any compliments to the komrim, you're not saying thank you, you're not giving any gratitude, then it is permissible. Then if you look at Rashi on Daf, Nun Aleph Amud Bet, he actually interprets it differently and says, Shalom b'tova is shalom yalu skar l'komrim. That's as long as you don't pay money to the priests. If you do it for free, it's fine, because there's no hekdesh to avodah zarah. And that means they can't consecrate the item to avodah zarah. As long as it's not avodah zarah, tikrovet avodah zarah, you can benefit from that bathhouse. If you have to pay for it and then pay money to the komrim, then we have a problem, because now you're actually giving money or compensation to them, and that we don't want. So as long as you use it for free, that would be fine. That's a stira between the Rashi here, who says that as long as you're not complimenting them, it's okay. But if you give a compliment, it's problematic. Over there, he says even a compliment, it wouldn't be problematic. It's only if you actually pay for it. And you can see that the Rabbeinu Chananel learns exactly like Rashi over there. He says, Shalom b'tovah k'lomar b'chinam. As long as you're doing it for free, or you're getting the benefit for free, it's not a problem. But if you look in the Baalei HaTosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam disagrees with Rashi, and the Rabbeinu Tam favors Rashi's explanation over here, which means tovah, and Shalom b'tovah means with a compliment or without a compliment, and says that if it meant compensation or no compensation, it should have used the word schar. And therefore the word tovah, and Shalom b'tovah, which is actually found in the Mishnah Yod and Shvi'it, and over there the meaning is to encourage someone, or to compliment someone, or to say thank you to someone, and the meaning is similar over here, which is that you're not allowed to do it if you give a compliment, but if you don't give compliments, you don't thank them for it, it will be totally fine according to the Rabbeinu Tam. But that also means that according to the Rabbeinu Tam, that there's no issue then with paying or compensating the Komrim of the Avodah Zarah. Because if you're compensating them, then you're not complimenting them. You're having a business dealing with them, a business transaction with them. You're not giving any kavod, reverence, or thanks in that way that uplifts them as the people in service of their bodhisattva. What about the fact that today we go to the ovens of the priests and we use their ovens? And we mill our grains in their water mills. But die leka lemechash. You don't have to worry about it. The lomi bay bischar deshari. Because if you pay them, that's not a problem. We're not giving them anything saying, thank you. What a great job you did. You're so nice. All the other things that you could say. What the Rabbeinu Tam points out is that if you compensate someone for something, then that is the quid pro quo has been taken care of with the money. So you did this, even though it belongs to the priests, when you pay for the service, then you're not really thanking them for anything. You're not doing anything that requires you to give a compliment to them. And then if you don't pay for it, then you have a problem, because then in some way you're indebted to them and you have to give them a compliment as that compensation. That's where the problem arises. Ella, afilu shelo b'schar nami mutar. He says, even without paying them would be mutar. In the case where Rabbeinu Tam is speaking about, these tanur and kirayim are not in the church itself. They're outside. They're in a separate area. So even though they belong to the priests, they're not necessarily dedicated directly to the avodah zarah, because they're probably by the residences of the priests, not in the Beit Avodah Zarah itself, as opposed to the story here, where it's in the Beit Avodah Zarah. And then he brings other examples of that from the Yushalmi in the next parak, which is Chalilin Shalavadat Kochavim Asubar L'Spobem. The flutes of the Avodah Zarah, you're not allowed to use them in the eulogies. V'mayum alim schar l'medina, if you pay the government for their use, afakav she'en osin l'tzorech Avodat Kochavim, even though they're made for the purposes of being used in front of the Avodah Zarah, mutar l'spod mehem, you can't eulogize with them. Chaniyot shel Avodat Kochavim asolim l'skor mehem, you're not allowed to rent out storefronts or stores of the Avodah Zarah. V'mayum alim schar l'medina, if you pay to the government, afakav she'en l'tzorech Avodat Kochavim, mutar. In all of these cases, it is mutar. First of all, it's not a problem anymore of tovat hana'ah, because you're paying for it, and it's not that you're complimenting them or giving some gratitude to the Avodah Zarah or the priests of the Avodah Zarah, which is the problem. Giving them gratitude is an acknowledgement of who they are. If you rent from them, that doesn't indicate any allegiance to the Avodah Zarah. Renting from them is simply a business transaction. That is permitted according to Rabbeinu Tam. And he notes the Yushalmi in the subsequent perek that also seems to say something along those lines. When you're using the flutes of the Avodah Zarah, that's problematic. But when you rent it from the country or from the government itself, that means that it's available to all citizens, and you rent it doesn't mean you're saying anything about the Avodah Zarah. Even though the item was made for the Avodah Zarah, still, it doesn't say when you rent it that you have any allegiance to that Avodah Zarah. V'ani omer eina gnuva, I say that it wasn't problematic. Shelo b'tovat Rabban Gamliel k'tovat acherim dami. The thanks of a Rabban Gamliel is very different than the thanks or the compliment of other people. By stam people, unless you speak up and you compliment or thank the individual, then there's no problem. That's not called bitova. You're not giving any credit to the Avodah Zarah. By Rabban Gamliel, who's a big gun, he's a nasi be'eretz Yisrael, he has significant political power, not only within the Jews, but even within the Roman authorities. The nasi was given a certain amount of power or had authority. So now when he attends the bathhouse, his mere showing up there is a compliment to the hosters of the Avodah Zarah. So Rabbi Gamaliel, even if he went there and said nothing, that would be a compliment. Rashi the Shitato over here, who believes that the problem here is if you give thanks or gratitude to the Kumrim, the mere fact that someone of Rabbi Gamaliel's stature comes here, that is as if he's thanking them or as if he's giving some sort of reverence to the Kumrim or the Avodah Zarah. His mere presence is that. You don't even have to state anything. You just have to make any verbal confirmation in order for that to be true. We have a similar case in the Gemara in Kiddushin, where it says that there's some times where a person can actually give money and end up that being the consideration for the Kiddushin. Generally, in order for there to be consideration for marriage, Erusin or Kiddushin, the man must give the woman a certain amount of money. The Gemara there describes a story where a woman gives money to the man and the Kiddushin are chal. And that's in a case where he is a ish gadol, where he's a person of significant political standing or a person who is a great person. Then when he accepts a gift from someone, That in itself has monetary value. When they accept your gift, that in itself is a compliment that has value to it, and that's consideration by which the man could marry the woman. And that's actually the way the Rabbeinu Kananel explains it over here, which is, if Rabbeinu Gamliel goes in there for free, which according to the explanation of the Rabbeinu Kananel means that it's fine, tovat acharim dami, it's similar to other people compensating. Lama, why is that true? When they see Rabbeinu Gamliel is bathing in this bathhouse, acharim rabim baim berochatzim umehanim labodat kochavim. Then many more people will come. It's free advertising. The bathhouse can say, Rabbi Gamliel bathes here. And that will attract other visitors or other people to come here. And that way, he's benefiting the Avodah Zarah because of the fact that he's actually giving them free advertising. And so the equivalent of him providing compensation to them, because when he goes in even for free, it's as if he is giving them value, even though he's not paying anything. He has, just by his stature, value. The same way that if someone cooks for the president and then he wants to advertise on the cook or the chef of the president, for him that's a meaningful status or stature that will actually give him monetary value in terms of advertising, in terms of his personal standing, and he might even cook for the president for free just to get that stature as being the chef of the president. And that's what is being said in the Gemara and Kiddushin, regards to the individual who accepts a gift from someone. Sometimes the acceptance of a gift actually gives value to the other party. The other party is so excited that you accepted the gift that they would actually pay money for you to accept the gift because that gives them importance, that gives them status, and therefore there is actual consideration from the party that's the recipient, even though it seems counterintuitive. And similarly over here, Rabbi Gamliel's mere presence in the bathhouse has monetary value, that he's providing them, and it's as if he is paying them by waiving the fee that he should receive for appearing there or advertising for them, he's actually compensating them. Similar to the placement of objects in a movie, where sometimes the people who own the objects or want to advertise the objects, they pay the movie to have them there. The movie needs them to be there, but nevertheless, the people want them in the movie because that gives them free advertising, and they're willing to compensate for that. So you see there that sometimes, even when the party who is in need of you or doesn't provide you anything, there's still monetary value, and if Rabbi Gamliel waives that monetary value, it's as if he's paying for his admission to the Beit HaMerchatz. Rav Shimi Bar Chiya Amar, Gduvta Mehocha. So again, here you can see, as the box showed you before, that the Amar comes afterwards, which means that he's arguing or disagreeing about why this was a problematic answer and what was this conclusion. The Gamar Lo, Zomedet Alabiv, B'chol Adam Mashtinim Bifanel. That the problem was that he says that this Aphrodites is sitting above the sewer line, and everybody urinates over there. B'chi Mashtinim Bifanel, my hobby. Just because you're urinating in front of it, why does it make a difference? Vatnan, we have a Mishnah further on that says, Rak Bifanel, Hishtin Bifanel, you spit in front of it, you urinate in front of it. Girira, dragged it along, B'zarak Bat Tzoar, you threw feces at it. Harizo, Eino Bitula. You dare say that that does not remove the Avodah Zarah or Shem Avodah Zarah from the object. Rashi says and notes that the Gemara later on will tell us that the reason behind this is because we only see this as a temporary hiatus in their relationship. He's mad at the Avodah Zarah now, so he's doing these things, but these aren't things that are permanent in nature. They are a degradation in the standing of the Avodah Zarah temporarily. When he comes back and says, you know what, he wants the Avodah Zarah back, he'll wash it down, he'll clean it up. It doesn't change the status of Avodah Zarah. Unless you do something that really alters the Avodah Zarah in some way, or makes it clear that this is a permanent bitul or rejection of the Avodah Zarah, that's not going to be a bitul. So here, just because they're urinating in front of it does not in any way degrade the status of this being Avodah Zarah. Maybe that's temporarily they're doing that, and then they'll restore their relationship with it, or they'll figure out they can't keep it over there because they want to give reverence to it. That is not a problematic answer because as we explained, that over there he has a temporary disliking or anger at this Avodah Zarah, but then he'll do it for a short time period and then he'll go back to worshiping it again. Problem here is that day after day after day, people are going and urinating there. You can't say that's temporary. They suspended the Avodah Zarah temporarily. It's permanently suspended. That's what they do. They only urinate there. That's pretty clear that they don't see it as a avodah zarah. Rabbi Bar Ula Amar, Gnufta Me'ocha. It was a lightweight answer because of this. The Kamalei, Ein Omrim, Nasim Echatz Noi L'Aphroditi. We don't say make the bathhouse decorative or adorn it to Aphrodites. Ela Nasim Aphroditi Noi L'Merchatz. The other way around. Aphrodite is the decorative part of the way to decorate the bathhouse. V'chi Amar Nasim Echatz L'Aphroditi Noi. Even if you said, let's make the bathhouse decorative and adornment to Aphrodite, my hobby. Why would that matter? Matanya. Don't we have a brayta that says, Omer bayit zeh l'avodat kochavim? If a person dedicates the house to avodah zarah, kos zeh l'avodat kochavim. This cup is going to be dedicated to avodah zarah. Lo amar klum. He didn't say anything. This is what we saw earlier in the Masechta as well. She'ein ekdesh l'avodat kochavim. You can't sacrifice something towards avodah zarah. The only two ways to make something asur for avodah zarah. One is that it is avodah zarah, you're worshipping it. Or the other way to make it asur is it's the krovet avodah zarah, which is that it's being offered towards the avodah zarah. But anything that, even if you have in mind to bring it towards avodah zarah, or dedicate it to avodah zarah, that doesn't have any meaning until action is taken. So over here where it says, Naaseh merchatz l'Aphroditi noi, person says, let's make a beit merchatz as an adornment for Aphrodite, why does that matter? Why does it matter what they said? What they said has no bearing. You're right, it doesn't make it asur when they say make the bathhouse an adornment to Aphrodites, but it does mean it is decorative or an adornment to Aphrodites. Rashi explains that the noi here is the fact that you bathe there, that's as if you're giving an adornment or decoration to the avodah zarah. So even though the beit merchatz itself, because you can't dedicate something to avodah zarah, there is no such thing as hekdesh to avodah zarah. So there's no isur in the bathing. But the fact that you do bathe there, which is, ihava rechitza noi l'avodat kochavim, the rechitza itself is a noi, or some sort of adornment or reverence that's been given to the avodah zarah. So therefore, it's asur li'apot avodat kochavim. You can't decorate or benefit avodah zarah. Whereas the Bali Tosafot say that what Rashi is saying seems very problematic, that Rashi is being oser, the fact that you are bathing in the bathhouse of the avodah zarah, which is not restricted because there's no hektesh to avodah zarah, but your mere bathing there is a yapui to the avodah kochavim. It's some sort of improvement or adornment to the avodah zarah. The Bali Tosafot say that's just not true. The yapot of the avodah zarah is usually something that's directly placed on the avodah zarah or done to the avodah zarah. Your mere bathing can't be in that classification. And therefore they say that even though it's not a sur midoraita, nevertheless, it would be a sur midorabanan, because it would make sense to be marchik atzmo, mikomagomi derabanan, miyesh le'asur le'anot mishum isur noi. That even though technically it's not a sur midoraita, nevertheless midorabanan, if something's built for the avodah zarah or in honor of the avodah zarah, it doesn't seem right that a person will go in there and bathe or do something in there. Rashi says it's because it's literally considered to be miyape, the avodah zarah. The Bali Tosafot just say that the chachamim should have been oser in that case because it just is inappropriate that you're going to something that was built in honor of the avodah zarah, even though halachically that has no status min haTorah. Nevertheless, from the perception of people, there is a problem. Although maybe you could explain Rashi similar to what we saw in the beginning of the Masechta with regards to the holiday when an individual cut his hair. That was considered to be a significant event. And they used to cut their hair in honor of the avodah zarah, or in dedication to the avodah zarah. It might have been true with regards to bathing as well. They didn't bathe every day. They bathed once a week, once a month. And so if a person came to do a significant event like bathing, and it was done in honor of the avodah zarah, or because it's in the courtyard of the avodah zarah, it's considered to be a certain amount of bathing for the dedication towards the avodah zarah, that might have been what the problem is over here. Even though the merchatz itself is not restricted, the activity that's done there is done in honor of the avodah zarah. Not just because the mere utility is considered to be honoring the avodah zarah, but the bathing is a sort of dedication to the avodah zarah, and that's what the problem is. Okay, we're going to stop here at the end of Ben Daled Amud Bet.